lot to cover this morning, not least of which is the handouts, some of which are somewhat confused. But if you don't have the handouts, talk to Emma Kate at the end of the session. You don't really need them during the session. I thought we would just be efficient and hand them all out today, but of course, efficiency is overrated, apparently. Just a word about a couple of things. First of all, the ELCA Church Council did meet last night, some 60 people, Microsoft Teams, and passed the document unanimously. Oh, thank you. Oh. That's a lovely interruption. So that is really good news. If you have a copy of the handouts, it's not the first page. That's the 2016 resolution that was passed, after which practically nothing happened. The second page, a declaration to American Indian and Alaska Native peoples by the Evangelical Lutheran Church America, four pages. That's what was passed last night and will be rolled out, we hope, for Indigenous Peoples Day, which is So anyway, but you are the first people outside of the ELCA Church Council and the folks who wrote it to get access to it. So be fruitful and multiply. It's not officially released yet, but, you know, I sometimes have some suspicions about official releases and the processes that have to go through. You've just received it, so do good things with it. And thank you for that. There are some more here, and if there aren't enough, apparently the second handout that wasn't attached to the first, it's a one page with a blank back, telling and teaching the truth, the church's obligation to education about the ongoing legacy of the doctrine of discovery, is a statement within the last 2 weeks from the Lutherans and Anglicans in the U.S. and Canada. And so the Canadians, of course, are ahead of us on this, and the Episcopalians are ahead of us as well. But we got to sign on as well. So that was just signed by the four presiding bishops. But that's also an important document that you can use as you go out and tell the new story. I had a couple of follow-up things from yesterday. There were some questions about the Supreme Court case, Johnson v. McIntosh, and then about the city of whatever versus the Oneida. Actually, what they had to do with was right of occupancy and whether land ceded by treaty to a tribe that wasn't continuously occupied from the first treaty until the time of the lawsuit. That's what was at stake. And in each case, the one argument was that, no, the tribes, they didn't have to be there. It was a treaty right. And what won was, you move, you lose. So that's a little bit that I can tell you about that. And then I've also had a couple of people talk about terminology, which is always interesting. I have been told by the ELCA Native American, American Indian, Alaska Natives, that First Nations people is the preferred use in Canada. It is not the preferred use in the United States, even if we like it. So that's one thing. Are they Native Americans? Are they Indians? Most people that I talk to say, it doesn't matter. Most Native people, Indigenous people, that's how I get around it, although that's sort of cheating, say it doesn't matter. And frankly, if you want to be really correct, call us by our tribal name. So, you know, relax about that if you weren't. Okay, well, today we're going to, the session, the topic is called The Church and the Indigenous Peoples in the Americas. And most of it, we're going to be seeing a documentary about the National Indian Lutheran Board, but I'm going to do some introductory stuff before that. The documentary is an hour, and I'm going to speak more than 1 minute, so it's going to go past 11:30. If that's a problem for you, you may leave. And if you want to keep watching it, you may stay. It'll certainly be done by lunch. So I want to start out with another passage from Genesis. Genesis 13. Now Lot, who went with Abram, also had flocks and herds and tents, so that the land could not support both of them living together, for their possessions were so great that they could not live together. And there was strife between the herders of Abram's livestock and the herders of Lot's livestock. At that time, the Canaanites and the Perizzites lived in the land. Then Abram said to Lot, "Let there be no strife between you and me, and between your herders and my herders, for we are kindred. Is not the whole land before you?" Okay. So we are going to look at the attitude and relationship of Christian churches in general, and the Lutheran Church in particular, as it relates to indigenous peoples in North America. And I could not resist starting with myths about Native Americans from the book by Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, who also wrote the Indigenous Peoples History of the United States. And on the back of the first page in that handout, there are the 21 myths, which are really kind of charming and horrifying all at the same time. All the real Indians died off. Indians were the first immigrants in the Western Hemisphere. Columbus discovered America. Thanksgiving proves the Indians welcomed the pilgrims. Indians were savage and warlike. Indians should move on and forget the past. Europeans brought civilization to the backward Indians. The United States did not have a policy of genocide. U.S. presidents were benevolent, or at least fair-minded, towards Indians. The only real Indians are full-bloods, and they are dying off. The United States gave Indians their reservations. Indians are wards of the state. Sports mascots honor Native Americans. Native culture belongs to all Americans. Most Indians are on government welfare. Indian casinos make them all rich. Indians are anti-science. Indians are naturally prepossessed to alcoholism. What's the problem of thinking of Indian women as princesses or squaws? Native Americans can't agree on what to be called. Indians are victims and deserve our sympathy. You'll get a chance to talk about those later on, but I thought they were very helpful. Europeans coming to the New World. And I got some wonderful stuff out of this book called Religion in the New World, The Shaping of Religious Traditions in the United States by Richard Wentz. And he talks about a lot of the religious traditions, but talks about what it meant to Europeans, especially the first Europeans who thought about coming to the Western Hemispheres, and how the Europe was basically kind of a mess. And there'd been a lot of wandering, a lot of pillaging, a lot of warfare. Things were falling apart economically, ecologically. Disease was rampant. And so this idea of a new world, I mean, just think of it, a new world. They talked about it as and saw it as a new Eden, a place of endless possibilities, and as a promised land. That's not taking into account at all the people who were there, and we know what the leaders said and thought about the people who were there from having heard, done all that awful stuff about the doctrine of discovery yesterday. But those Europeans, you know, frankly, the ancestors of most of us, were seeing this in part as an opportunity, as a way to start over again, and maybe even in grandiose kind of biblical terms. Now, another book that I found very interesting and helpful was a book by Thomas Newcomb called Pagans in the Promised Land. And he talks about some of the different models that the invaders used kind of to justify what they were doing. And the first was the conqueror model, The second was colonizing the promised land. The third was the chosen people and a promised land model. I mean, clearly, you know, taking the biblical designation of the chosen people and claiming it for themselves. And I should probably say for ourselves, because, you know, that's where my ancestors were. Then there's the model of converting Christian discovery into heathen conquest. So going from finding something and being able to be there with new hope and new promise to conquering the heathen. And then the whole Christian nations theory. Now, in reality, this is pretty much a bunch of land acquisition, right? I mean, just taking the land. And also, at least for the Brits, an opportunity to unload some of the desirables. You think of those pesky Puritans. You know, please get out of our hair. You know, go. Yeah, Plymouth is a great place. Go ahead. You'll love it. Or, you know, the bothersome Quakers. Yeah, I think Pennsylvania would be we'll give you some land there. Just go. Take all your Quakers with you. And, you know, there is a history of undesirables. You know, Australia, penal colony, but undesirables on these shores, not necessarily that they were criminals, although some of the folks who came over were, but also religious minorities, outsiders, got kicked really far outside, across the ocean and into this inhospitable or possibly Eden sort of a land. Now, what about Lutherans? Well, Lutherans, of course, generally didn't come and especially start working with indigenous people as early as some of the other traditions did. And at least half of the early Lutheran efforts were sort of in conjunction with other Protestant efforts. So it is kind of cool to think that we didn't invent ecumenism as 21st century Lutherans, but that some of the early ones. And even it was just because these three failed and then we tried and failed, still, you know, there's something there. In 1645, John Campanius was called to Fort Christina along the Delaware. He learned Delaware and he translated the small catechism into Delaware, which is kind of cool. Pretty much all of those Swedish Lutherans along the Delaware eventually decided it was to their advantage to learn English. They did and became Anglicans. But still, you know, nice start. There was an effort with the Stockbridge Indians in Massachusetts who eventually got relocated to Wisconsin. The Congregationalists worked with them, then the Methodists and the Presbyterians, and eventually, after they all gave up, the Missouri Synod came in the late 1800s. Also in the late 1800s, Niels Nielsen was in Oklahoma working with Cherokee folks. That's a mission that was started by Moravians, and then the Lutherans kind of took it over. In 1894, Tollef Brevig went to Teller, Alaska, and began work with Alaska Natives there. And I want to read a little piece that was written in a pamphlet about American Indian Alaska Native Lutherans in the ELCA. There have been many other faith groups who have come into indigenous communities for the last several hundred years, having a long-term effect on Native peoples, positive and negative. The Lutheran experience is limited, with few ministries making it out of the long and complicated history of engagement with indigenous people. We need to recognize that other denominations took more seriously the role to missionize and Christianize indigenous peoples. We lift up that fact to acknowledge the unique history that the Lutheran Church has. So, there's that. In the U.S., lots of dreadful things were happening in the 1800s. Manifest destiny was coined as a phrase and lived out. The Dawes Act, you know, basically allowed reservations to be broken up into private property, which is a concept that doesn't really fit with traditional understandings. In the late 1800s, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School was founded and became a model for boarding schools in the U.S. and Canada. It's a terrible, terrible legacy, and we'll be talking about that Thursday night and Friday. And then in the Supreme Court cases in the 20th century. But I want to talk about in the 60s, as there were civil rights movements in the United States, the American Indian Movement was one of the movements that developed. And God works in mysterious ways, because the American Indian Movement kind of invaded an ALC, American Lutheran Church National Convention, and took over a college dormitory, took over a college building. And out of that, I mean, I'm way oversimplifying it, was forged the National Indian Lutheran Board. We may not have had a great track record, but at least we didn't make huge numbers of awful mistakes early on because we weren't doing anything at all. I'm not sure that's a good, yeah.
What year was that?
Well, that was in 1969 that they, and then in 1970, the National Indian Lutheran Board was founded. Couple of really amazing things about the National Indian Lutheran Board. It was pan-Lutheran. That means it was at the time the LCA, the ALC, the Missouri Synod, and you know, others were involved in it. They worked together for social justice. 75% of the board members were American Indians. And so it was a majority people who weren't Lutheran Church treasurers. Because they weren't. And, I mean, that's really significant. And every year, the National Indian Lutheran Board, every year of its existence, they gave away more than $200,000 a year to projects around the country that were done by and for and with American Indian folks. It wasn't church projects. It was indigenous projects for them. And I think that is incredibly, incredibly powerful. I mean, the NILB was with the AIM as they went into Washington, D.C. and occupied a building there. We're very active in advocacy for some of the legislation in the 70s that was really incredibly helpful. So, you know, it's just kind of one of those odd things. Why the Lutherans, you know? Well, they were there, I think. Lutherans were kind of plentiful and thick in Indian country, and Indians were kind of plentiful and thick in Lutheran country. So it's kind of one very simple way to take it. But what impresses me so much looking back is that Lutherans took a risk and acted. We didn't have a 7-year study, you know? And we didn't worry excessively about frightening or angering people, which it did. It frightened and angered people. And that Lutherans did not have to be in control. 25%, not 75%. It was all inclusive. It didn't cover all of history, though. I mean, it wasn't all inclusive, excuse me. It didn't cover all of history, all of theology, all of spirituality. It was of the moment, and it was powerful, and it was effective. And I just want to do a quick contrast with something that our church did in 2019. In 2019, our church was asked at the churchwide assembly to sign on to the Poor People's Campaign. Now, does that sound like something we would do? Of course it does. I mean, almost everything about the Poor People's Campaign is the sort of stuff that, oh, I don't know, Jesus might have said, you know? But in the end, we voted no. And do you know why we voted no? No, you don't. We voted no because not absolutely every platform of the Poor People's Campaign matched up exactly with every platform of every social statement that we'd ever made. Not necessarily that we'd spoken against it, but we just hadn't had we didn't have a position on it. And so out of an abundance of caution, of which we are really good, we did not vote yes. So, you know, that's the kind of thing, just comparing those two, it's, well, you can fill in the blank of what it is. Some of you here from Edina Community Lutheran know Dick Magnus, raise your hand. or even if you're not from there, raise your hand. Okay. Dick Magnus is a white guy, and he was one of those white guys on that board. And he's written some really good stuff. He says, "I recall how we non-Indian people learned and became committed to walking with tribes in their fight to protect treaty rights. Our lives were changed as we worked with Lutheran Indians and their access to tribal nations as they opened our worlds to the incredible partners in Indian country." He said, "Lutherans had a reputation in Indian country as trusted and effective partners working for justice. Our system of governmental ministry in the states and Washington, D.C. were and still can be excellent structures to organize and amplify the work of ELCA members. Tomorrow, we will get into, so what happened to the National Indian Lutheran Board, the inside story. But we're about to watch it. I just wanted to tell you, if I wasn't clear enough previously, about this this handout. The first page is the repudiation of the doctrine of discovery that was adopted in 2016. We'll be talking some more about that in the next couple days. And then nothing happened. Then there's those wonderful myths. On the back of that is the declaration that was voted on last night. We see it as part of the follow-up to the 2016 resolution. And then this final piece that was not stapled to anything is the Lutheran Episcopal Anglican Canadian Lutheran thing that just came out. Are there any questions? Are you ready to go? Ready to go. Okay, you can talk to me later if you have questions. Thank you. We shall drum roll to see if the technology works.
Yes, I just want to briefly point out that this cord is running up this way to the projector, so be mindful of that so you don't trip and that it does not become disconnected. And I'm also going to make some more copies of these handouts, and we'll have them at the end if you didn't receive one. All right.
The following program is a presentation of the Interfaith Broadcasting Commission and the National Council of Churches.
The 1960s was a time of discontent and social unrest, a time when the ignored and the forgotten stood up and demanded their civil rights. For Native Americans, the awakening was 500 years in coming. Chained up all the doors, locked them, nobody could get in. There was a lot of people on the outside that supported us.
We took Alcatraz because we felt, as students, that we were strong enough to make our voice heard. The 60s was an exciting time because a change was really taking place in the whole United States with the civil rights movement. And Indians became empowered by the War on Poverty programs. New leadership was emerging from the communities. I feel like I'm a product of that.
I was drawn to the movement of the time, which was the movement towards Indian self-determination and Indian sovereignty. And as we saw our own political identity and our own political power, we had to control our programs and our services. After we met in Sioux Falls for the second meeting in 1970, we organized a national board, cross-section of Indian people, from young activists to tribal officials, from very extreme sort of protest groups to very conservative Indian people in grassroots communities. Thank you.
When looking specifically at Native civil rights, there are many stories of unjust incidents. For the Minnesota Dakota, one story predominates. In 1862, when part of the nation was preoccupied by civil war, the struggle for civil rights is frozen in this photograph.
The largest mass hanging in the history of the United States. And then when we talk about the history of what happened from that time to the present, it's a tremendous history. And it's a lot of emotion, a lot of feelings, going very, very deep with our people, with me.
My Dakota ancestors were living a very natural life in which everything was related. The land provided them their food, their shelter, their religion, their very way of life. That natural life was coming in conflict with colonial civil society, where power was dominant and everything was separate.
For quite a few years before 1862, there had been tensions building up in the community on the Dakota side, particularly. The Dakota had given up a lot of land and had been pushed by the settlers to a narrow strip of land along the Minnesota River.
They agreed to deliver annuities and provisions as a part of the treaty, but there was a civil war on, and delivery of goods and annuities to a small tribe got very low priority.
Our people are starving, our children, our elders. The cornfields failed the last year of 61. They didn't have any corn to eat. Finally, the young warriors in their society got together and say, look, we have to do something with this. Let's go to war.
August 17, 1862. War breaks out between the Dakota and the United States. From southern Minnesota, the Dakota rose up. The war lasted several weeks, and the Dakota, overwhelmed, had no choice but to surrender. Records show more than 500 soldiers, settlers, women, and children died, but with no concise account for the number of dead Dakota.
It was the largest kangaroo court. Some of them only took a few minutes. All of the men were found guilty to hang by the neck until dead.
The military didn't view the Dakota as a sovereign people fighting a war, and instead they were viewing them simply as individuals out killing and robbing. And I think it was an important element in Lincoln's decision that he had to execute some significant number of individuals in order to show that there were consequences for what had happened in the war.
Lincoln pardon all but 39, and eventually there was one that they let go the last minute.
On that fateful day, the prisoners were led out of the prison. They were shackled, chained together, and had hoods. Dakota women began wailing and weeping. One of the prisoners, hearing them in a loud voice, said, "Hear me, my people. Today is not a day of defeat. It is indeed a day of victory. For we have made a peace with our Creator, and now go to be with Him forever. So remember this day to tell our children, so they can tell their children, that we are honorable men who died for a noble cause. Do not mourn for us. Rejoice with us. It's a good day to die." And then he began lifting up his voice and began singing.
The civil rights movement, starting in the 1960s, as defined by community organizer Bob Moses, has two distinct traditions.
There was the community mobilizing tradition, directed at large-scale, short-term public events, best known through the Freedom Marches led by the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr. The other tradition was directed at long-term development through community organizing with ordinary men and women.
We were in the Deep South, and when they learned that I was a clergyman, one of the guys said, "Sid, why don't you help your own people?" I said, "The black civil rights struggle is a struggle for all oppressed people, not just black." And that was Martin Luther King's philosophy. If I'm willing to be a part of the military to fight for this country, I ought to be willing to die for my own people and for the people who are oppressed.
Growing up on a small reservation in South Dakota and visiting a lot of the other reservations, I could see the anger and the frustration that elder people had, but they were not expressing it outward. The young people were beginning to express it outward through acts of personal destruction. And I used to see young men who would drink and go out and literally beat their hands against the wall until there was nothing but flesh and blood as a way to prevent their frustration.
Becoming acquainted with a new movement, I think what interested me was the people that were involved, the young, educated, non-educated thought of what the truth about what happened to American Indian people in the last 500 years of historical trauma, but also the ability of Indian people to fit in somewhere and to make a livelihood to live.
I remember as a child that there was a fire here. Somebody's home was burning. And so you had fire trucks come. City of Phoenix, City of Tempe. And they're debating who has jurisdiction. Who should be putting this fire out? And they do nothing because of liability. And the house burns down.
And the police brutality was so bad back then that the racism was so terrible, you know, in the dead cold winter, they would arrest, they would come down with their paddy wagons. They had a big, they call it the Black Mariah, it was a big black paddy wagon. They'd come down and load Indian people up. They'd go to the bar and just take them by the neck and pull them in. If they didn't have enough room, they'd actually handcuff Indian people along a lake pole. And they'd sit there sometime and like that in the snow or in the rain until they come back and they'd shut it around and pick them up.
For me, it was probably a traditional Navajo life. The teachings of the Navajo people, the spoken words that the elderly tell you when you're still a young man about life, about education, about land, about people, the love, about the religion, about the character, the language, and all of that. I could still hear a lot of those echoing through my own ears when I go about doing things on a daily basis, even here. So it's, I guess, in so many respects, the great spirit touching you to do certain things, to go certain routes.
I joined with a group of young activists all over the country who went about challenging institutions, occupying buildings symbolically as a way to say we're taking back our land.
I have a dream.
The civil rights movement differed from the American Indian sovereignty and self-determination movement. Civil rights focused on eliminating segregation and supporting integration, while sovereignty was about reversing forced assimilation and protecting the tribal homelands.
What was happening in the churches was part of the changes that were occurring in the larger society, where there was more awareness about civil rights, particularly black civil rights, but could be easily translated to civil rights with American Indians. And that's sort of what happened, particularly the membership and leadership within the different denominations.
I saw it at the beginning, a door opening up to be able to maybe solicit support from the synod, or the Lutheran Church, the interaction that was going on. They had programs, they had an Indian division, was my understanding, that handed out clothes, and we wanted more than clothes.
I always saw the communists in two ways, or why they were different. The federal government wanted to assimilate Indians, which was that we would no longer exist, and they wanted to integrate other people of color. So when you look at those questions like that, then you can understand the dynamic of how you have to work in those communities.
A lot of people, when they do interviews and talk about the movement, they say the movement started here in Franklin Avenue, here in Minneapolis, Minnesota. But for people like myself and Eddie Vincent Benet and Dennis Banks and others, we knew that the movement began in prison. We wanted the community to give us a name. And after 2 weeks, I was confronted one day where two ladies came into the office and pulled me outside and wanted to talk to me. And I went out there and asked them, why don't you call yourself AIM? I said, well, wow, what does that mean? It says American Indian Movement. And I said, well, we don't want to call Indianism. Well, this woman, she just kind of jerked them. She said, listen here, Sonny. She said, in India is what they use to oppress us. And Indian is what they use to gain our freedom.
I came out of graduate school at Arizona State University having read these books about this great organizer called Saul Alinsky. And I went to Chicago on my own to learn from him. Well, simultaneously with actually my organizing in Chicago and training, Indian people were meeting with the Lutheran Church in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. The American Indian Movement was challenging the churches, and particularly because the American Lutheran Church was headquartered in Minneapolis, they were challenging the Lutheran churches to establish a national board, to create a national staff, and provide money for Indian organizing across the country.
In July of 1969, the three largest Lutheran bodies, the American Lutheran Church, the Lutheran Church of America, and the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod, met with a group of Native Americans in Sioux Falls, South Dakota, and formally accepted the concerns. However, the next formal meeting was not scheduled to be for 1 year. The Indian people couldn't wait.
We decided, well, let's really do this. Let's really go and take Alcatraz.
On November 20th, 1969, 80 Indians docked at Alcatraz Island and declared to the world that they were taking back Indian land.
We were the first generation of Indian people who were not subjugated to the government boarding schools where we were being controlled. We were in the cities, we were free, we could make our statements. We wanted to legitimize the fact that being Indian was okay and let them know that we still had a lot of issues back home that the federal government had never dealt with. The only time that I really was worried was towards the end when they wanted us off the island. They were hoping that we'd just all leave. We had an impact not only on our Indian people to be proud of who they were as Indian people, but it had an impact on a lot of people who were poor people or other minorities who have never had a voice.
Although the occupation lasted 19 months, it would be the first of many to receive national and international media attention.
But the demonstrations, this was something that Southwestern Indian Development did do. We were really focused on our issues. We weren't focused on larger issues, but in fact, really didn't see what was happening, except maybe going to a conference and hearing about it, but the driving force here was the community getting organized and going down and meeting and demonstrating that, to show what our positions were, what our concerns were.
The movement took hold. A lot of people became proud to be Indian again. They were lifted, you know, they were, overused word, empowered.
Empowered also was the feeling and level of activism which increased throughout Indian country, including the Mohawk school boycotts, Cherokee protests over state hunting laws, Northwest Indian fish-ins, Navajo demonstrations against the exploitation of coal, Alaska Natives picketing over oil and gas development, and many other demonstrations.
I was asked to go to this meeting in Sioux Falls, South Dakota in 1970, which largely the American Indian Movement was organizing and their challenging of the Lutheran churches. So I brought with me an organized constituencies of Dakota people. So if you could organize the churches, you can organize millions of people behind injustice, behind eradicating poverty, behind the issues that you were developing within your community.
I guess that's what struck home and one of the reasons that Americans for Human Opportunity spent so much time is a level of ignorance by the general public about Native Americans and tribes and tribal culture was just beyond. And then people of importance who were in decision-making positions were just heartbreaking that here these people are making decisions on our behalf and they don't even know who we are, much less have any understanding of us.
When I went to work for the National Indian Youth Council, I entered an organization whose composition of the organization were young Indian people, highly educated. I mean, four-year degrees, master's degrees, PhDs, lawyers and doctors. And there was me.
We set up a very loose agenda, and I knew from my experience in black confrontations that if there's a really militant group, they're going to say, here come the white people again, setting our agenda and telling us what they have. So I was introducing the program as we went on, wondering, when are they coming up? The agenda wasn't that great, but finally Dennis Banks and Clyde Belcourt came up and they said that you people are telling us what we want to do. If we're here to do it, we have to get together first and decide what we're going to say to you. So we're going to have an Indian caucus, and I'm asking all the Indian people here to walk with us. And so out they walk, and these Lutheran structured people were always sitting and dumbfounded because, you know, they were paying for this meeting, and these people were walking out, and they wanted to set the agenda. And it's sort of comical, but it was frightening for a lot of people who had never been in that situation before. And they said, well, when will they come back? And I said, I don't know. They're going to determine this. And what will we be talking about? I don't know, I would say.
And as a result, a national board was organized, and we put forward the challenges of a national staff position and millions of dollars to support Indian organizing and needs across the country. But since the church did not respond, AIM, in its protesting style, took over one of the dormitories and demanded that the national executives respond and approve the elected board before the dormitory would be released.
We, of course, chained up all the doors, locked them, nobody could get in. There was a lot of people on the outside that supported us. So we told them right flat out that we were not going to leave there until the three presidents of the three Lutheran Senate called and said that they would abide by those challenges.
Lutheran churches had executives from throughout the country, even though they're not the top leaders, who were supporting this effort. We were also provided with an assurance that we did not have to be converting Indian people to Christianity.
Working with groups in Denver and with National Indian Lutheran Board was to begin to see the phenomenal leadership of persons involved in the community, and not just to see the poverty, the difficulty of life. What NILB helped us to do was to see potential, to see people with phenomenal skills who wanted to give those skills to help the quality of life be increased for all that they had a chance to work with.
One of the most influential men of the time was Eugene Crawford, the first American Indian hired as executive director of the National Indian Lutheran Board. His Dakota family had been exiled from Minnesota after the 1862 Dakota War.
I was checking in and started to go down to get rid of my luggage, and Gene jumped up and muscled me into coming in to register at the hotel, and Gene just picked him up by the neck and kind of pushed him, pulled him around like this, and said, "Darn you, use your little stronger words. Darn you, Russell," said, "we've been trying to help you, and now I hear you're bad enough." And he said, "No, no, Gene, no, no, I didn't. I didn't do that." So I was very impressed, I must say, because I was always a little intimidated by Russell myself.
We've done a lot of arguments with Gene, you know, what we thought he should do, what program should be funded, but he had his own way of doing things. We always compromised on him. We just never got our way with him. I think that's why we were effective, that we had people like him.
In the beginning, we knew little or nothing about the Lutheran structure. And by the same token, the Lutheran structure knew nothing about the Indian world. So it's always been an ongoing priority with the National Indian Lutheran Board to develop bridges and understanding between the two worlds.
Floyd Red Crow Westerman was also a Dakota exile from Minnesota, who became a musician, an activist, and a well-known Hollywood actor. He served the American Indian social justice movement through both his songs and political work. He is perhaps best remembered for his album, Custer Died for Your Sins, based on a book written by leading American Indian scholar, Vine Deloria Jr.
I had the opportunity to meet Floyd the first time when we did a concert together, and I believe it was in California. And I always was amazed with that really rich baritone voice of his and that really warm smile that he commanded the stage because he owned it every time that he got out there. He was very wise. You know, he went through a lot to do what he did as well. Anyone that was involved back then in the movement, whether it be music or whatever, if you were singing out what was called back then protest song, you didn't have it easy. Floyd was an example of someone that everything he said, whether it be in song or word, came right from the heart.
History sort of defined a relationship amongst a group of us that formed a network around the National Indian Lutheran Board. There was Vine Deloria, who was becoming the emerging contemporary writer and legal scholar of the time. There was Floyd Westerman, who was the emerging Indian musician and actor. There was Eugene Crawford, who was really in one sense, our symbolic and leading figure of the National Lutheran Board, who was an educator. And then myself, who was a young organizer, all of us came through the exile and ended up in South Dakota.
I look at the very broad spectrum of grants that were given and the impact on various communities to address poverty, to address hunger. I know of incidents where people would have had nothing to eat for probably days if it had not been able to access a food bank or a soup kitchen. There were grants for helping build a longhouse up in the Northwest. A canning factory was established. It provided income for some of the employees. The grants never exceeded $4,500. The reason for the limit of $4,500 is this could have been like seed money, which would generate money from other organizations. It could be seed money for government projects. It could be seed money to bring other churches into partnership with the Lutheran churches. They were responding to a human need, and that's what we're supposed to be about. As people, we are supposed to be in partnership with others.
You were an Indian community sending in a request for a grant. The requirements for that Indian community, because the Indians were imposing it, was tougher than most granting organizations. They were supposed to come in with a report every quarter on how they're spending their money. And if it wouldn't be there, they would withdraw it. You know, in other words, the Indians who were making their proposals weren't just coming in for a grading training, they had to really press their cause and justify what they were requesting.
NILB for me stands out as the perfect example of how to conduct ourselves as people of faith and how to reach out to and to be reached and to embrace and to be embraced and to listen and then to be listened to and then to partner up and to work together.
When I first came to work at Indian Rehabilitation, that was in 1979, our total funding, including running the program and salaries, was $30,000 a year. One of my first experiences was meeting Joel Schlappenhafen with Lutheran Ministries, and they were helping us with some of the grassroots needs that we had. They were renovating our kitchen, and we got funding from the National Indian Lutheran Board. And they helped us get our program in compliance, you know, with health compliance and those kind of things. They also funded some of our needs around just supplying food for people on a daily basis, those that were homeless on the street, and also the men that were eating congregate meals in our program.
November 1972. A caravan of over 800 Indian people traveled across America and arrived in Washington, D.C. They planned to meet with the Bureau of Indian Affairs officials and deliver what is known as the 20-point proposal.
In 1972, the National Indian Lutheran Board supported the American Indian March in Washington, D.C., the transportation, food assistance, and housing the marchers in local churches all along the way.
I remember one specific incident with the National Indian Lutheran Board. They had come to Washington, D.C. when the Congress was in recess. Nixon's in California, and so were most of the cabinet members. By the time they arrived, they had the authority to meet with them. You know how bureaucracies are, they're playing their shadow. So nobody would meet with them out of frustration. They just didn't go to their own state day until somebody was going to pay attention to them.
That was my first week as a director of the National Congress of American Indians. And I think I didn't sleep much during that entire week of the activity. Our efforts didn't work. AIM pretty much ignored us. So we generally stood by if we were needed. We hoped to be able to help.
Margaret Gopher and I went down because we heard there were Oklahoma Indians who had come in a long walk to Washington, and we wanted to see if they were any relatives of ours. So we went down, and John Cabell saw us, and he said, upstairs, O'Donnell, Margaret, come on, you know, come on in. Because they were like the Red Sea had opened up and let us in. And the U.S. Marshals were going to attack the building with all the Indian people of all ages in there. And so I decided, well, at least one thing, I'm a senator's wife, I could stay in there, they wouldn't attack the building with me in there. And so I started calling them, and they said, well, now, who are y'all talking to? And I said, tell them that you were ready to negotiate, and tell them that to set it up with the people in authority. And they did, and the people in authority said, well, we don't have the authority to negotiate, but they had the authority to attack them. I thought, that was such a wild, crazy thing.
In a movement, eventually, nobody has control. If there's so many people involved, no one person can really decide what's going on. And people get frustrated and things begin to occur. The National Lutheran Board was one of the leaders in the aftermath of the occupation of the Bureau of Indian Affairs building in Washington, D.C. to organize a national network to create a national response focusing on the real issues facing Indian communities.
When AIM and other Native people left Washington, D.C., the FBI classified AIM as an extremist organization and added the names of its leaders to a list of key extremists in the United States.
One of the stories related to the movement of the times and the activism that was taking place is that the Justice Department, all the way from the FBI to the local police force, were assigning police officers to monitor and develop some type of a relationship with the Indian groups. And Phoenix, Arizona, where I was organizing with Southwestern Development, a police officer by the name of Rudy Santa Cruz was assigned to us. And even though we weren't the American Indian Movement in Phoenix, we were assigned a police officer.
We established a good rapport with him, and in some way, at least for me, it gave me some assurance that they were there and that they could document that we weren't doing anything out of sorts and that we were nonviolent protesters, demonstrators, and that we had legitimate issues.
One day I asked Rudy, I said, Rudy, where is the AIM caravan today? He would leave and come back and say, they're going down Highway 66, an old beat-up truck, with an Indian, with a redhead van and a cigarette in his mouth, with a drum tied in the back of the truck. What else do you want to know?
One region that was truly in need of help was the border area around Pine Ridge, South Dakota. Many Indian beatings and unsolved murders had occurred, and racial tensions were about to explode.
The leadership of Wounded Knee were making their own decisions. They were deciding what they wanted. But on the outside, the whole world was watching the Sunday-run, day takeover. And the federal government was trying to figure out how to respond to this without major violence further occurring, without hundreds of people being killed.
Although the National Lutheran Board was not involved in the actual occupation of Wounded Knee, it monitored the siege with the National Council of Churches and worked to establish a national bail bond fund for possible arrests and trials.
The advocacy issues that NILB got us into were complicated because you had to listen to, as pastors and congregations, the concerns and fears of your members, but at the same time have a teaching task of helping them to understand that God is really calling us to what's good for all people, and therefore needing to look at the opposite side to say, is this what God is calling us to at this point in time?
After the takeover of Wounded Knee, the leadership of AIM was so caught up in legal issues and court cases that they no longer could participate on the National Lutheran Board. National Indian Lutheran Board continued to organize all over the country and on national issues, working with the other coalitions in Washington, D.C., and related to the tribal and urban communities.
In the early 1970s, a third of Native people fell below the government's official poverty level. The average U.S. income was $10,429, compared to Native earnings of $5,226. Along with the basic needs of the family, health care was one of the biggest issues.
I'm from Pine Ridge, and as a resident of Pine Ridge, I saw some of the devastating effects of the diseases and problems and conditions. Polio was a prime problem when I was growing up. 1950s, alcoholism, substance abuse, suicides, STDs, cancer, particularly diabetes were pretty rampant on the reservation.
The issues of health care and unrecognized tribes were brought to us by the National Congress of American Indians, by LaDonna Harris, who was organizing all Indian strategies in Washington, D.C., and by Vine Deloria, who was really the philosopher of the sovereignty movement.
In our urban hearings, one of the things that we made a point was just because Indians did not live on a reservation, under the treaty, we were entitled to services wherever we were.
One of the dynamics of getting this national network together was that gave us enough people to not only write legislation and get them presented to Congress and get Congress to pass them, but enough people to get the support of the president to sign the legislation so it became law.
Lutheran Council in the United States of America was a way in which the different church bodies came together to do some forms of ministry, such as the Indian ministry through National Indian Lutheran Board. So it brought together church bodies that didn't work in lots of other ways together, but on these concerns could say, we are of one mind, we want to be supported here. And that led to being able to be useful in Washington, because there was an office related to the Lutheran Council that helped do advocacy work, which assisted with some of the major issues that the Indian community was working on.
We got the church groups involved in this as a civil rights, human rights issue. We brought all our allies, because I had been working outside the Senate in all of these different organizations, because that's what I would do at home, and Franklin in the Senate could use his skills to get it out of committee.
The real key there was when it came together as a law, and it was lobbied through Congress pretty much intact. Office of Management and Budget, the president's own chief advisor in these issues, was strongly pushing for a veto. And there were people on Capitol Hill who didn't vote for the legislation that were hoping that it would be vetoed and were pushing for it.
One of these organizations was that there was called Congressional Wives, and we'd have a meeting in so many months as a way of socializing.
LaDonna Harris was a friend of Betty Ford, and calling Betty Ford and urging that tonight over tea, why don't you talk to the president about this? And sure enough, it worked. I don't know how much that had to do with it, but I would think it had. So that was true. We were sweating it. We didn't know that it would be signed by him. And he signed it courageously, but with an awful lot of good pressure.
There was a lot done with different issues of advocacy. And one of them, where I worked in Denver, really came from a passion of a woman who had lived in the Northwest and was involved with us in trying to build education and awareness around Indian concerns. And treaty rights around fishing were a big issue for her, having experienced that in the Northwest. So she was trying to help all of us to understand the way the treaties function and the way that gave an advantage to the Indian community in salmon fishing. And of course, we learned, as we heard this, that this was not terribly popular with even Lutherans who were involved in the fishing industry. And that as advocacy was being done in this area, there were divisive conversations that the community was divided about. Should the Lutheran Church be having anything to do with this? Why should these treaties still be supported? Isn't this a new day? Shouldn't we be able to move on? Well, the issue may be a little bit different, but it still is a time for us to be looking at how those treaties need to be continued to be supported.
After the passage of the Indian Health Improvement Act in 1976, one of the major problems was that you had to be federally recognized in order to receive the service. And most Indian people in the United States were not federally recognized. So that's where we had to go next, to work with the unrecognized tribes.
Due to lack of resources and difficult conditions on the reservations, most tribes did not have the capacity to fulfill the government's arduous procedures to regain recognition. It was through the support of the National Native Network, of which NILB was a part, that many tribes successfully reclaimed their federal recognition, and others advanced their claims to be recognized for the first time.
I remember being at a meeting in Tempe, Arizona, and this Yaqui Indian man came to our meeting by the name of Anselmo Valencia. And he came and asked us to support the Yaqui people, who were actually people from both Mexico and the United States, give federal recognition. And so the National Indian Lutheran Board took that on as our first effort to work with a non-recognized tribe. And we provided money and we helped write the legal analysis that the Yaquis needed to petition for federal recognition.
We have our own language, we have our own religion, our own culture, and even though there was an artificial boundary between the U.S. and Mexico, it did not take away our Indianness, our Indian identity. So this community, along with many other Yaqui communities in the Tucson and Phoenix area, they were not reservations. They were Yaqui communities settled by the early families coming to the Arizona Territory, escaping political persecution.
Well, with recognition with the Yaqui tribe, I think the main thing was to have land ownership. That differed from the other tribes in the sense that there was many civil rights issues that came along with that. The other tribes could focus more on those issues, and whereas the Yaqui tribe had some real basic issues, which was just living, having a place to live in a community to be a part of.
Anselmo Valencia told me how many of those elected officials were saying, why should we give you federal recognition? we did not have a war with you. And Selma Valencia turned and said, okay, that is true. You know what? If that's all it's going to take, then I will go home tomorrow, organize, because we still have our military society, declare war on the U.S. government, and yet we're going to lose in a matter of seconds. Well, you then give us federal recognition. We're embarrassed by his comment and his challenge.
So the National Tribal Chairman's Association was formed, and they're the ones also that fought against the recognition of small tribes. That if you allow more small tribes to get recognized, that cuts the pie into thinner slices, you know, the big federal budget pie, and we all get fewer dollars. Kind of separated us when we really needed all the unity we could get.
A piece of this is really a weird piece that I really mentally cannot understand. The Lumbee people from North Carolina. They have been so abused through the years, through their efforts of trying to get federal recognition.
The largest unrecognized tribe that the National Lutheran Board worked with was the Lumbee tribe of North Carolina. The Lumbees have been struggling for over 100 years to get full federal recognition.
So we got all these great people together thinking, these great organizations thinking, boy, this will be smooth, and we get the National Congress to back us up and then change the regulations and markings and what it is. We just ran into a blank wall. Those of us who have been working with these groups were amazed at the resistance. I saw it personally as a great political move of bringing more Indians to have more numbers. But some reason, the National Congress turned it down.
Early on, the Lumbee came to join the National Congress of American Indians and came to the convention and were declined by the credentials committee because you have to be a tribe with a governing body. And they could never convince NCAI that they were a tribe. They came as a development corporation.
We provided them with dollars to do additional legal work, to help rewrite the petition, to help advocate the National Congress of American Indians and other national bodies to get behind and support the Lumbee issue. The challenging part of the Lumbee issue was because there are so many of them, their numbers would challenge the federal Indian budget. And so money became the issue. You know, if the Lumbee got recognized, there were not more federal dollars allocated, and they would take away much of the money for many of the other tribes. So the fear of that resulted in other tribes not supporting the Lumbee.
So many more tribes have been recognized, and it hasn't caused the budget crash that a lot of the more fearful tribal leaders were projecting.
March 28, 1979, tragedy strikes the east coast of the United States with the nuclear meltdown of Three Mile Island, receiving international attention. However, months later on the Navajo Reservation, the largest accidental release of radioactive material in U.S. history occurred at Church Rock. A uranium tailing dam burst, sending 1,100 tons of radioactive mill waste and 90 million gallons of contaminated liquid pouring into the Rio Puerco River.
I also remember right about that time, Three Mile Island, and how that was in the news on television all the time. The same thing happened on the Navajo Reservation among the Indian people, among the Navajo people. And you didn't hear about it anywhere.
The release of millions of gallons of waste material from the uranium mill into the Rio Puerco River has created a long-standing concern from the community from Pinedale chapter through Church Rock chapter, all the way down the watershed into the state of Arizona, because the Rio Puerco does flow quite a bit, and it eventually contributes to the Little Colorado River, which then contributes to the Colorado River.
But it wasn't in the general public response that you would expect, nor did the governmental, the response of the various governments, state and federal, seem to be a real alert and concern to the issue. a professor of physics from Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota, spent a year there. People that were brought in with an NILD grant from around the country, panel of five, and they made their assessments and made their recommendations for how things more properly would be done in the future with regard to regulating the mines and monitoring the effect of those mines.
April of 2005, the Navajo Nation Council considered a law called the Dene Natural Resources Protection Act, and that law was a proposal to ban uranium mining and milling. It was received with overwhelming support and was enacted into law.
Energy is important. A lot of our energy is through water, but that's going to diminish as water diminishes. So, you know, the future of the Southwest particularly, as well as in other parts of the country, really are in the hands of the Indian people. So those are a lot of the two interrelated issues that tribes are going to have to strategize on and work out really become an important player at the table for the future of the Southwest.
The National Lutheran Board, which was organized in 1970, came to an end in 1988. It came to an end with the reorganizing of the Lutheran churches. The Lutheran Church Missouri Synod pulled out of the Lutheran Council USA, which was the platform which the National Lutheran Board attached itself in a parallel body to these three churches.
The Missouri Synod did not really intend to back away from Indian concerns, but there, in this new grouping, where an ultra-conservative group became the leadership in the Missouri Synod, decided we don't want to be doing this with the American Lutheran Church and the Lutheran Church of America, those two church bodies, because we don't think that they're quite with us in faith matters.
When the Lutheran Church was reorganized, they began to focus inward rather than outward. When they focused inward, they wanted to assimilate the National Lutheran Board into the newly formed Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. So there would no longer be a National Lutheran Board.
We lost our grant process, which was very harmful to the communities that depended on the partnership of the Lutheran churches. We didn't have the authority to provide those grants again.
One of the things that I think was lost in the formation of the New Lutheran Church and the desk, the Native American desk, was the strong self-determination that was a part of the National Indian Lutheran Board in the new structure. It's taken a long time for us to get to the point where we realize that that is a tremendous loss that took place.
Though the combined resources of the National Indian Lutheran Board may have been lost, the core network of leaders remains to develop communities, whether they're urban or whether they're on the reservation, and continue to work to break down barriers between the two.
So we made a commitment and a decision among the leadership that we would all go back home. So I came back to Minneapolis, and I think things just kind of mushed on me. And I ran into a man by the name of Dr. Leon Sullivan. He's a Martin Luther King number one lieutenant, one of the prime organizers in the South. And he told the people there in that room, all the black leadership, by the end of this year, he said, we're going to have an Indian arm of OITs of America. This young man here is going to run it. We've trained over 30,000 people. We took 26,000 right off from wealth alone and put them on payroll in our job training program. And we started developing lures in that tribe. We created the Indian Health, the first urban Indian health program in the nation. Our legal rights center, I went to a board meeting 2 months ago, celebrated their 60,000th case. I like to see the whole avenue lined up with Indian programs and Indian business. That's the heart of our community.
Well, Franklin Avenue, we're trying to bring together tribal resources with urban human capital and financial capital, and targeting a particular physical location, which is Franklin Avenue, where there's enough consolidation of land right now to actually build out a physical cultural corridor. Along with Franklin Avenue, there are other projects developing across the country, one of which I've been working with is Native American Connections in Phoenix, Arizona.
So now, 29 years later, we have 110 employees, we have about a $7 million operating budget. We serve about 75% Native people and 25% whoever touches our door. Now we own 15 sites around the valley. We have housing for seniors, we have housing for people with HIV and AIDS. We have housing for women coming out of domestic violence shelters where it's not safe for them to go back home and they need a helping hand to start again. We have a shelter called Pendleton Court that can just reach out its hand to women out on the streets. Maybe they're having addiction to meth or alcohol addiction and they're out on the streets with their children and they can come into Pendleton Court.
I saw it growing from a vision, a dream, to a place that needed a lot of work, to something that really was becoming very strong and had a great future, and that proved to be the case.
I think the future is bright. The young people, Shetahitotah means the young people will be raised, get educated, they'll come back, they'll take us. That's the beauty of the young people.
All of the colonial countries now, their people are coming back from their colonial countries and coming into their countries, so that it's a whole new world. How do we coexist in this world and be able to maintain our cultural and political autonomy? How do we maintain our indigeneity, we call it?
Well, I live increasingly within a global environment where more people with differences are coming into interaction with each other. And so we can either become more at odds with each other, or we find the area where we are one with each other and break down the barriers of separation globally as well as locally.
Kota oya te kia. Kokata kia maunitite, yushkia, washagia maunitite. We are people who will walk toward the future with strength and power and compassion.
We've seen how war and social issues and religious and cultural misunderstandings divide and separate us. There are lessons to be learned from Native people and religious leaders who stand up together and act as one unified force for change. We'll never solve one problem or resolve one issue until we change our thinking, learn to relate to one another without the need to dominate, control, or destroy. I'm Peter Coyote. Thank you for watching.
This story of the National Indian Lutheran Board represents a historic period in the relationship between Lutheran churches and American Indian and Alaska Native people. We share this experience to demonstrate that culturally unique communities and leaders can find a common voice for overcoming social injustice and expressing civil rights. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America has reaffirmed its commitment for American Indian sovereignty and self-determination with this documentary production of Native Nations Standing Together for Civil Rights. This team of producers from the Native American community shared their history and talents to put this program together. We are all in relationship, one with one another. The Evangelical Lutheran Church in America will continue doing what our predecessor church bodies began. We continue God's work with our hands.
That was 13 years ago. Actually not. But we're working. We've sort of taken it up again.